Seven and a half seasons of White Walker threats have led up to this climactic Game of Thrones moment, the Battle for Winterfell. And it did not disappoint. We'll chat about it on this edition of Pop Life.
Digital content on WAER is supported by SRC Incorporated, a not-for-profit defense contractor working to create an exceptional employee experience through respect, teamwork, and the freedom to innovate. Learn more at srcinc.com/careers.
The most intense battle of A Game of Thrones took 55 days to film, 750 people on scene, and it was the longest battle sequence in film or TV history, and it featured battling dragons. I'm Joe Lee, and welcome to Pop Life. We're breaking down Season 8, Episode 3, A Game of Thrones, The Long Night. And to help me with this task is this week's Game of Thrones geek, Matt Lincoln. He's host and anchor for CBS 12 This Morning out of West Palm Beach, Florida. What's up, Matt? Welcome to the show.
Joe, thanks for having me.
So you've been watching Game of Thrones from the very beginning. Did you read the books? What's your deal?
So I didn't read the books, and I was a little late getting started. I had sort of kids and didn't watch TV for a couple years, and then I caught all the way up, watched everything probably within the last 2 years or so. So I was ready to rock and roll and be a part of this, and I actually enjoy that better because I feel like I have better recall than some of the people at work and some of my other friends who I didn't watch. You watched season one, you know, almost a decade ago, rather than me, who kind of watched it, you know, a year and a half ago.
Right, right. No, that's a good point. Though people like me, I've watched it the entire season probably three or four times, but but I'm geeky like that. So before we get to this past episode, I want to check in with our fan poll. So we asked the question, what was the best boss move of the game? The best power grab? Here are your options. Lady Olenna Tyrell's low-key poisoning of Joffrey. We had Tywin Lannister's orchestration of the Red Wedding. Khaleesi's unsullied army grab. Littlefinger assumes control of the Vale, and Littlefinger backstabs Ned Stark. What was your favorite power move in A Game of Thrones?
Well, it's got to be the moment of the show, right? And the Red Wedding is it, man. I mean, that's the episode that sort of changed everything. You know, I mean, we had characters we thought that we were going to be with for the long haul, and after just a couple minutes, they were all gone. So certainly Tywin showing what sort of just cutthroat nature that they all have as Lannisters, making that all happen, that's my favorite.
Yeah, that was one of the most talked about episodes of the entire series, Tywin Lannister orchestrating the Red Wedding. The actual poll results, and this is from my Facebook group that I'm a part of. It's the Game of Thrones Small Council. It now has over 800 members. It was a tie between Lady Olenna Tyrell's low-key poisoning of Joffrey because she essentially shifted the balance of power on the throne with that move. And then tied with Khaleesi's unsullied army grab, which immediately put her in a power position having an army. So I think I voted for Khaleesi's unsullied army grab. So there's our poll for the week. Now we're going to get to The Long Night. It was a dark, cold night. Everyone's on high alert. Everyone's on edge. So in the previous episode, it was the night before the fight. This is the actual fight. What's your overall impression of the episode? Everything from visuals to how the thing moved. What did you think after you turned off the television?
You mean what I could actually see?
What you could actually? That's
it was
a big,
pretty dark.
That is
for,
a big complaint.
A big part of it. And unfortunately, you know, I'm on the morning show down here in West Palm Beach, so I get up bright and early, so I have to watch the following afternoon because I have to be up at 2 a.m. So watching that episode in the daytime I've had to try to find blinds to, you know, I'm taking like cardboard boxes and like boxing off like windows just so I could see what was happening. No, but it was an exceptional episode of television just from the whole spectacle of it all. There's so many huge scenes. The way that they worked with the intensity of so many different moments was so great. I will say, I don't know if it's my favorite chapter of this story. Mm-hmm. And I think I definitely have issues with where the Battle of Winterfell leads us all and where it fits in the Game of Thrones, the Song of Ice and Fire, the Song of Ice and Fire as a whole, like how this whole battle fits into everything. Mm-hmm. But as just an episode of television, it was pretty incredible.
Yeah, we're going to talk about your overall impressions in terms of context and how this fits into everything closer to the end of the show. But we get things started in the dark. So a lot of folks have complained about how dark the episode was and that you couldn't see detail. I happen to think it was intentionally designed that way. It is a night fight. There's going to be a lot of confusion. You can't see. And a lot of the anticipation and nervousness, at least for me, up front, was not being able to see the enemy. And so we get started by the Red Witch, Melisandre, coming back on scene after having been chased out of town by Jon Snow and Davos Seaworth. And she sort of blesses the Dothrakis by having them raise their swords and setting them ablaze. And that leads into what I thought was just one of the most visually stunning parts of that episode, where this entire horde of Dothraki horsemen ride into the dark with flames ablazing on their swords. Did you dig the way that those flames got snuffed out pretty quickly?
Well, no. I mean, how could you? You know, I mean, 6 years of the Dothraki following Daenerys all over the world to have them basically sacrifice themselves right in the course of about 10 seconds. I mean, it was, looking in hindsight, I mean, we spent so much time with them and that army, what we believed to be the best army in the entire world, and Essos and Westeros, everything. It was supposed to be the best army, and they were sent out there into the darkness to die.
Mm-hmm.
I think John failed here on the plan of how to, you know, to take down the army here, because there are so many issues. Like, why would you send the Dothraki like that? They're also, you know, great archers. There's so many different great things that you could have the Dothraki do other than just run out there to die.
Yeah. Well, one thing that struck me was all the brown people on the front lines. So you had the Dothraki and you had the Unsullied army as pawns just out there for the slaughter. I think that was to be expected. But yeah, when they rode off into the night and all you can see from a very high angle sky shot down were all these flames just heading together was awesome. And then all of a sudden, sword by sword and clumps of swords by clumps of swords, they began to extinguish. You kind of knew stuff was about to go wrong. Mm-hmm. And then it gets quiet, and all of a sudden a few horses come back, and then all of a sudden some Dothrakis come back. That's when I knew this was going to be a rough evening for the Allied forces. That was interesting to have Melisandre back, because she has been foreseeing a lot of – she's been a key character in this entire thing, foreseeing a lot of what's going to happen, foretelling a lot of what's going to be going on. Though I think, you know, at times it seemed like her visions were erroneous, but I think they just played out the way that the – Lord of Light wanted them to play out. So she first threw all of her eggs in the Baratheon basket, and then that goes haywire, and she pretty much almost disappears. But it was good having her back because she played another important scene, and that was when they had some trouble getting the trenches lit. So they dug a trench around the castle and filled it with flammable stuff. And I guess Daenerys was supposed to fly down on a dragon and light that thing up so we could create a barrier between the forces and the White Walkers. but because of the cold, couldn't get it lit. And then we have Melisandre step in and do her witchy thing. Let's take a listen to that.
Don't look at it!
I exios on your Elon Misas. I exios on your Elon Misa.
So I don't think anyone didn't think that she was going to light the flame, but they just did a great job with the anticipation and the angst. Because it wasn't lighting, and she began to get distracted by whites and everyone else. What did you think of that scene? Were you on the edge of your seat?
Yeah, I mean, this is really the time where you're hoping just about anything goes right for the living, right? Because we had just been through however long that was, where it looked like we were down all the Dothraki, all the Unsullied, and this was it. And it was good to have just a little breath. It didn't last long. Right, but at least there was just one moment where something went right for the living, and at least it gave us all a breath from seeing all that death.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the Bic lighter company is going to be hiring Melisandre to do any commercials anytime soon. She could not get that thing lit early enough or soon enough for our folks. Great scene with that one. We had an intense dragon battle in the sky with Jon and Dany taking on the Night King and his resurrected dragon, Viserion. And I think it was interesting to have the Night King bring in this harsh weather. So it was, I think, a relatively clear night until he arrives. And all of a sudden, we have these Syracuse-like winter conditions. I mean, it's like no one here was shocked by the weather. We thought that looked pretty much like Syracuse. But that presented some issues with Jon and Dany being able to see and give an advantage to the Night King. The Night King, we're going to talk about that because you and I think, agree with how that story arc took, you know, what, 7.5 episodes to develop, and mm-hmm. in pretty much a half in an episode is like taken care of.
Yeah.
That was the battle, the episode, all of that was great, but the whole Night King thing, I'm still left with a dozen questions.
So many questions. You know, what did he really want? You know,
yeah.
We went through so many seasons of him orchestrating how he was going to make new White Walkers with the kidnapping over on the taking the babies out on the other side of the wall, and then he was leaving all of these intricate signals for everyone behind him. Then he had all those at least three times where he had those knowing looks, stare downs with Jon. I mean, there's so many times there was some sort of sign that this was not just imminent death. This was not just brainless, mindless, let's end the world and kill everything that's alive moving towards Westeros. You know, it was something else. But
yeah.
All of a sudden, now it's not. Now it's just gone.
Yeah. Yeah, so the Night King thing is probably going to be the thing that I question the most after this entire series is over and I sort of break it down. You spend 7.5 years of building up this mythology. I think the book does a better job of explaining the mythology. The television series leaves a lot to be to use your imagination. And so I wish the Night King had said some words, said something, gave us a reason for why he was. Obviously he wants to take over the world, but why? It just left me a little unfulfilled. Though, it was a visually stunning battle sequence with the dragons and everything. One thing that I noticed a lot of people were questioning was why he didn't burn in the fire. And we knew that fire didn't burn him. We saw that in the fight scene when the allied guys, the good guys, went to go capture a white. The Night King walked through dragon fire in order to throw his spear at one of the dragons. So you should have caught that one ahead of time. But it was a pretty interesting scene to have him fall, literally out of the sky off a dragon, have a dragon descend on him and load him up with all kinds of fire, and then have him sitting there smirking back at Danny. That was a pretty cool scene, actually.
It was, but I'm totally with you in the sense that this is where the show does fail a lot of times, is in its explanation of some of the magic that's involved, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we know the show just crushes it with its interpersonal relationships and its dialogue and its battle, but when it comes to really explaining like what is happening, or even having an explanation at all that makes sense for some of the magic that happens here, right? Because the first thing I think of when the Night King doesn't burn is that he's a Targaryen.
Right.
Oh, he's got Targaryen lineage. This is a huge thing. We're going to learn here at the end that he actually comes, the whole lineage of Targaryens comes from the Night King, and that's a big thing. And it might still be. But I also sort of get the feeling like maybe he didn't catch on fire just because. Well, no, it's just because he's the Night King and he's made of ice and ice doesn't burn. You know, there are many instances actually where you can come up with questions of, Viserion, now that he's an ice dragon, is his fire fire or is it ice or is it magic? Like, there's just, they don't really explain a lot of the magic that
happens. Yeah, I don't mind that he doesn't burn, but give me some explanation why he doesn't burn but the whites do. You know, that one is a little lost on me. One of the interesting things was what I read was that the director, I think, watched the big battle scene from Lord of the Rings to sort of see when battle fatigue would set in and when watching for a viewer. And I wonder if that's when they decided to chop this thing up into two scenes, which was the battle scene beyond the wall. And then you come inside the walls and inside the castle. So you move from all of the battles, the fights, all the stimulus that a large group battle brings, and you go inside the castle. And now you're more in sort of horror movie territory because you are, going around corners, and you could have creatures jumping through open doors. And that became a lot more intense to watch as we saw Arya moving about, I think, the library, trying to avoid, roaming whites. It was a whole different experience, even though it was a part of the long night and the battle scene. Did you find that to be the case for you, that things got a little more intense as they got quieter and smaller group fights inside the castle?
Yeah, I mean, for my money, the scene with Arya in the library is the best part of the episode.
Yeah.
I mean, the intensity that's built in there. Now, I got a question again, why are the whites running around like crazy things, and then all of a sudden they get in the library, and it's like, shh, and now they're all just walking around. It's like the library, keep it down, whites. It's like weird that just sort of happened that way, but that was super intense, and now all of a sudden, you're not just being... it's not just a divulge of craziness happening as you're trying to see through the darkness and understand what's going on. It was nice to kind of quiet it down. And now, obviously, in retrospect, the whole episode really winds up being about Arya.
Yeah.
So to have the most important moments be hers added to the end of the show.
Yeah, and I think they needed that scene to sort of display her stealth ability. I mean, that's sort of that was a large part of her training, was being able to move around without being detected, sneaking up on people. So that was getting us set up for the end. One of the things that we knew would be coming was something was going to happen in the crypt. So they added the crypt to the opening sequence of this season. And there were a lot of scenes taking place in the crypts, a lot of dialogue and multiple scenes happening down there. And the repeated reference to it being the safest place. So we kind of knew something was going to happen. I knew exactly what was going to happen. I read a couple of articles that pretty much predicted that, and I thought it made sense. And that was, you know, the Night King has the ability to raise the dead. You got a crypt full of dead people. You had to see that coming, right?
You did, but I feel like they really lost an opportunity, right? I mean, this was the perfect opportunity to bring back characters of, you know, full past. I mean, where was Zombie Rickon? Where was Headless Ned? wandering around down there.
Where
right?
was Headless you know? Ned?
Or I mean, what I really like, I was really hoping that we were going to see Zombie Hodor.
Zombie Hodor
in the white. You know,
yeah, no,
through the whites, and all of a sudden there was Zombie Hodor. Like, I mean, oh,
I don't think they didn't bring Hodor. First of all, he's not family. He wasn't going to be buried in a crypt,
but he could have been following the whites whole way.
Okay,
I mean, think of everyone who died along the way. You know, we could have had Zombie Uncle Ben, right? I mean, all the people, the characters that have been killed by whites could have just been resurrected and been following them around.
Zombie
and,
Uncle Benjamin. Okay. It might have been a little hokey, but that would have been interesting. the next thing we'll talk about is Theon. So Theon, I've seen a lot of comments where people say Theon Greyjoy probably had the most character development of anyone in the entire season. And in this instance, he goes from he was sort of trained to be a coward, and he, in the final moments of this episode, shows himself to be quite the hero. He's had this cowardly relationship because of how he was tortured and bullied by his uncle, and here we have him standing up to the Night King. He stood tall in protecting Bran. He volunteered for that job, as a matter of fact. We're going to take a listen to the scene between he and Bran.
Theon. You're a good man. Thank you.
They didn't show him pissing in his pants. I'm sure he did. And all of the courage and all that in the world just didn't prepare him with any good fight moves. So he just runs. He just runs at the Night King with a spear and gets taken out in like 10 seconds.
Yeah, you know, the thing about Theon is why generally he's everyone's most hated character in the show is that he's the only one. The whole show is about heroes and anti-heroes, and then we got this one coward in the middle. No one at all, no other than maybe Tyrion at the beginning of the show, could you call a coward?
Right. Well,
but he was a coward over and over and over again.
Yeah.
He just stood there while Sansa got raped. He just stood there while Yara was kidnapped. He just stood there or jumped off a boat.
Right.
So you know. And what I thought was this was the most powerful moment of the episode for me because, you know, the resigned look on his face when Bran has those words for him, it's not just necessarily, it didn't strike me as much as, oh, that's really nice that Bran's saying those words. It's much more that this is it. You know, this is it for Theon.
Yeah.
And in the past, where Theon has stared death in the face, whether it be, you know, Euron's face or Ramsay's face, and he stared death in the face and he ran away, he runs towards it. You know, and I mean, think about this too. If Theon had chosen to be a coward and gone and hid behind the tree, he probably would have lived.
Yeah.
But in the Game of Thrones world, and in all worlds like this, you know, it is better to die a hero than it is to live a coward.
Yeah.
And it's beyond the whole show to figure that out.
This episode was really about sacrifice. I mean, so many people sacrificed their lives in the face of great odds. And Theon was probably the most high profile sacrifice. We do have to throw another coward in the mix, though, and that would be Samwell Tarly, who we saw laying in the middle of a pile of dead people, just blubbering like a baby. I expected some Samwell Gamgee from Lord of the Rings out of him by now, but he is still a pudding of a man.
Well, I mean, he didn't have to be on the front line. You know, he could have been down in the crypts with the women and children and Tyrion. But, you know, instead he went out there on the front line and he learned that it was too much for him. Let's not forget, he can't lift a sword. Okay?
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, it was pretty stupid for him to be out there in the first place. You know, it was too much for Samwell, and maybe, I don't know, maybe he is a coward. But he's done enough things. I mean, he went against the Citadel in saving Jorah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's a little bit of that's not a coward there. He stole, you know, the sword and left his home. That's not a coward. You know, there are a number of times in Sam's story in which he hasn't been a coward. He's just not really built for battle.
Yeah, not built for battle. That's an understatement. So the biggest. Obviously, the biggest scene of the evening was Arya Stark saving the day. There was a lot of speculation about who would kill the Night King. And she was in the top three of people mentioned. And I think now that it has happened, she makes a lot of sense. I think Jon and Daenerys would have been too predictable. And the show is not built on predictability. And so it makes a lot of sense that Arya would see that. She used a move that was foreshadowed in a sparring match that she had with Brienne of Tarth at Winterfell last season.
What do we say to the God of Death?
Not today.
Can we now proclaim Arya as Azor Ahai, or the prince or princess, as it is, that was promised? I mean, I think that mythology says that person would rise, sort of be reincarnated to take on the Night King and see humanity into the daylight. That's now happened. If that is the case, it seems anticlimactic in terms of the proclamation of her as Azor Ahai. What do you think of that whole theory?
Okay, so I mean, you know this. I'm going to guess you know this a little bit more than I do about the list of things that you know, because I remember most of the proclamation of who Azor Ahai pertains a little bit more to Dany and Jon.
Mm-hmm.
Things like they're made of dragon blood or born of dragons,
right?
Something like that. There are a number of lists of things, and when you look through that list, I just looked through it the other day, they don't really seem to pertain to Arya. So I don't know. You know, maybe...
Well,
I don't know the answer to that question.
One was that there would be a sword or a mythical sword or something like that. She didn't have a sword, but she had a Valyrian steel blade.
Right.
That's part of it. And you know, from what I've read, the mythology it can be loosely interpreted. You know,
okay.
in that it doesn't have to be too literal. The one key is that Melisandre, I think, foretold, especially in her previous meeting, and that's why they flash back to had the encounter with Arya and Melisandre, was to get us to think back to seasons ago, when they had that meeting, and she told her that she had a part to play. Mm-hmm. And a big part at that. So, and then here we have it was the moment. Now, for me, Arya Stark is my absolute favorite character. So that she would be the one that takes down the Night King. I mean, I was jumping off of my couch. I mean, I was like literally in there screaming. And it played out that way in our Facebook group as well. That people were just super excited about this young woman. Who has gone through so much. Now, we said that a lot of people said that Theon went through the most character development. I would say that Arya Stark went through the greatest transformation, you know, going from a little tomboy girl playing in the yard of Winterfell to being one of the world's premier assassins, you know. So,
you know what? I'm going to, obviously I can't. It's hard to disagree, but my favorite transformation of the show is Sansa.
Is Sansa? That's a dark horse transformation. Yeah.
Knowing of what we knew of Sansa back then and who she's turned into now. There's no way we could have possibly foreseen this happening.
Right. Well, and that brings me to something. That brings me to the point where we start looking ahead. Mm-hmm. And did you peek the interaction between Sansa and Tyrion in the crypt? There mm-hmm. seems to be the beginnings of an alliance between the two of them. Now they are legally married. There was some talk about that. And I don't know if they are naturally coming together or if Sansa is actually sort of beginning to play Tyrion. Let's take a listen to a little bit of that dialogue.
You might be surprised at the lengths I'd go to avoid joining the army of the dead. I could think of no organization less suited to my talents.
Witty remarks won't make a difference. That's why we're down here. None of us can do anything. The truth. It's the most heroic thing we can do now. Look the truth in the face.
Maybe we should have stayed married.
You were the best of them.
What a terrifying thought.
It wouldn't work between us.
Why not?
The Dragon Queen. Your divided loyalties would become a problem.
I feel like she's turning into a little bit of a puppet master. I think Littlefinger has rubbed off on her a little bit. She could be playing him, or she could be genuinely interested in creating an alliance in which they would seize a good deal of power together. It was not lost on me that Daenerys's one of her top advisors was in the room hearing that conversation. That information could be taken to Daenerys and that could begin to provide a split between a fracture in the relationship between Tyrion and Daenerys. Interesting stuff. I think one thing that I've learned from this show is that no dialogue is wasted. Almost mm-hmm. everything that is spoken means something. And I think that scene means a lot, and time will tell. What did you think of that scene?
I think that's interesting. You know, I think we all are sort of hoping this doesn't just end with Cersei losing in the final episode and everyone that's on the good side now is alive and happy and Dany and Jon are on the thrones together and Sansa's Winterfell and everyone's high-fiving.
That's too neat. That's too neat. Yeah.
Right? And so I think that's been the most interesting part of the first two episodes of this season is that all of a sudden it seems like the world's turning on Dani. Mm-hmm. And
she's turning the world against her. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean both, you know, yeah, but there's never really been up until these two episodes where it seemed like things weren't going to go Dani's way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, since season one, you know, everything has been building towards her becoming Queen of the Realms. Now, man, we all can see that how this is all sort of falling apart around her. And now Jor is gone, her most trusted advisor. So, yeah, I could see that as being an issue going forward as to Tyrion might have to pick a side.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe what the little relationship he still has with Sansa might bloom into something where he winds up not picking Dany's side at the end.
Yeah. Could be that's going to be a very interesting part of this show as it develops. I'm anxious to see because they, you know, Sansa pretty much played no role in this episode, but she is a power player now, and I have to think that they're going to take her someplace else. That it's not going to end with her just sort of being where she is. So I'm looking forward to that. That being said, though,
I think it would be hard to see her going willingly back to King's Landing. I mean, that's where so much of the most awful things in her life happened.
Right.
You know, so maybe she's different, and so maybe, you know, she wants to confront all those things now. But I can't believe that she's like, okay, yeah, let's go back to King's Landing again.
Could be that they're setting us up not for a prequel, but for a continuation. Maybe Daenerys and Jon take the throne, and then maybe Sansa stays back in Winterfell and says, "I'm the Queen of the North. Let's get it on." You know, that could be pretty interesting. You would imagine that with a great battle like we had, that we would lose some friends, and we lost quite a few friends. What was the saddest death for you?
Well, I think it was Theon. You know, for the reasons we sort of talked about earlier, I think there's also when a character is resigned to his death and you can see it in his face, I always find that very emotional. And I think for me, when I saw, like I said, when I saw that on Theon's face, when he knows he's going to die,
mm-hmm.
and sort of go back through everything that he's been through to get to where he is now, to then turn around and choose death as a hero, even though, I mean, it was pretty fruitless and kind of even dumb, at least he was going to go down swinging, and
right.
He had never gone down swinging before. I thought that was impressive.
Yeah.
And sad.
I think for me, well, the more surprising one was Little Lady Mormont getting slapped around by a giant like a flea. That was a little bit of shock. I think the most moving for me was Jorah Mormont, and that he has been through hell and high water trying to serve Daenerys, and to have him sort of coming to her rescue, saving her, and dying while doing it in her arms. That was a pretty moving moment, and to have it in the middle of the chaos of that battle. Pretty deep stuff. And we're going to do a little memorial at the end of the show to pay tribute to all who were lost. We lost Lady Mormont. We lost Melisandre, not to battle. But we lost Ed from the Night's Watch, Beric Dondarrion, Ser Jorah, and Theon as well. Any predictions?
And the Night King.
And the Night King, yes. and that bastard, the Night King.
Yo, we can't end this. So let's go back to the final scene again.
Okay.
Because I was not cheering when Arya came flying through the air. Because we haven't talked about Bran yet.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, there is something huge going on here with Bran that we are just deciding that the show has not touched on at all. First off, the biggest question from the whole episode, where'd he ward to for like an hour? The
yeah.
most important hour, he's just gone.
Well, if you believe the most popular meme out there, he was looking for internet connectivity.
Yeah, well, you know, yeah, he went to, I guess, get information or to guide to make sure that everything was happening the way it was supposed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end, Arya would kill it. But how was he doing all of that? You know, I've got to the point now where more so than who's sitting on the throne, more so than who kills Cersei, I want to know the part that Bran is playing in everything that's happened.
Right.
And one of the most meaningful moments of the entire series has been the Hold the Door episode.
Yeah.
That seemed to change everything, because now all of a sudden we know that how Bran can impact the future.
Right. But do you think you're going to get that from a series, at least the television production, that is not giving us much details, like with the Night King and his mission and all that stuff? I just wonder if we're even going to get.
I will be heartbroken if it doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many parts that he could have impacted to make, you know, what has happened in the show that happened because Bran made it happen,
mm-hmm.
that we don't even know about. And it's, we've got to have that at some point. Like, I thought as the Night King was slowly walking up to Bran, I wasn't worried about the Night King killing Bran. I wasn't thinking someone was going to come out and kill the Night King. I was thinking they were going to, like, handshake or something, or there was going to be some sort of connection. Bran was going to say something that was going to open up some sort of door that was going to give us some answers about who the Night King was,
mm-hmm.
what the Three-Eyed Raven really, how it really impacts everything around us, and was going to really be an incredible OMG moment.
Well, we still have to march down to Westeros, so he
mm-hmm.
could tell some tales on the way down there.
Yeah, he's so talkative.
One of the biggest points of confusion for a lot of people is Bran's abilities. A lot of
right.
people think that he can see the future, and I argue that he can't. He can see the past, and he can see the present. He can see the present by warging out. And a lot of people think because he was sitting in the courtyard saying, "I'm waiting for an old friend," that he was looking at the future, and he wasn't. He sent some ravens out to see that Jaime was riding up to Winterfell. So a lot of confusion about what his actual abilities are. He does have prophetic visions or prophetic dreams. We saw that earlier when he was before he became the Three-Eyed Raven. But those are pretty they're not crystal clear pictures of what's going on. They're just visions. So it'll be interesting to see how his powers or abilities are used to help win this battle, right? At a minimum, he could send crows out to spot where Cersei's armies are, where the navies are, you know, how many forces are out there. They didn't really, even though he's shared some information regarding the advancing armies of the Night King, they didn't really use it to their advantage in terms of battle strategy. I hope they do that going into this battle.
There's got to be a reason why. There's got to be a reason why that early on when we saw, when he was dreaming about being the Three-Eyed Raven,
mm-hmm.
the showrunners decided to show us the dreams.
Yeah.
You know, there's got to be a reason why they've decided to, you know, we know there's reasons why they picked a couple scenes for us to go back and watch, like the birth of John. I mean, all that stuff makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also times where he just goes away, and we don't know where he goes.
Right.
And there's got to be a reason why the showrunners are holding that information for us. And I think that's the key at the end. I think that's the thing that makes us all go, it all comes together and we all go, oh my goodness, I can't believe Bran's behind all this, all knew all this or
mm-hmm.
whatever. There's got to be another shoe to drop with Bran, or all this is going to be kind of a waste.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it will be a bit anticlimactic, especially if it plays out the way that most people think it will play out, with Jon defeating Cersei or Daenerys defeating Cersei. It's got to be more interesting. It has to be painful for someone, and by someone I mean Jaime, to kill Cersei. Someone has to kill Cersei, and that's got to be meaningful. It can't just be a dragon burns her or Jon sinks his sword into her. It's got to be a bit more impactful than that. Give me a prediction. Who's the ruler of Westeros?
Well, I think it's going to be John.
Okay,
so you're
going with the odds makers. The odds makers have him at 3-1. So you're with the odds makers.
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I think that too much about this show has been John's story, that it doesn't make a lot of sense for if there is someone sitting on the throne, that it's John.
Okay. We have John at the – so these are the latest figures, I guess, coming out of Vegas. Is that right, Kevin? Kevin gave me these numbers. This is coming out of Vegas. Jon Snow is 3-1. Sansa Stark is 9-2. Tyrion Lannister, 5-1 odds. Gendry is 5-1. I mean, I don't know where those theories are coming from. I'm going to have to explore Gendry a little bit.
It's because he's got Baratheon blood in him. But the thing is that no one knows that.
Yeah. No one knows.
There's no way he could have any rightful way because it's not like some CSI person's going to come DNA, test his DNA and show that he's got Baratheon blood in him. There's no way he can prove that.
Yeah. And then we have all at 8-1 odds, Daenerys, Arya, and Bran Stark. There are 9-1 odds that Cersei maintains power. And then Samwell Tarly at 16-1 odds. Give me a break. I mean, how? That one I don't understand.
Well, Tyrion's an interesting one, right? Because from the numbers that I've seen, Dany's chances have gone down mightily, and Tyrion's have gone up. Mm-hmm. And maybe that, like you said, that little connection that he's made with Sansa. If we lose all our Targaryens here, could we foresee a future with Sansa in the north and Tyrion in the south, and everyone's happy?
Yeah, yeah. Going to be interesting. Can't wait for next week's episode. Matt Lincoln, host of CBS 12 This Morning in West Palm Beach, Florida. Thanks for joining us, bro.
Joe, good. I was so glad to be here. Thank you.
And I want to thank my producer, Kevin Kloss, for putting this episode together. As expected, the Battle for Winterfell saw the demise of some of our favorite characters. So we end today's show with a memorial to Little Lady Mormont, Melisandre, Ed, Beric Dondarrion, Ser Jorah, and Theon. Until next week.
Aye, we left you. You're fat and you're slow. We didn't want to die.
For the night is dark and full of terrors.
House Mormont has kept faith with House Stark for 1,000 years. We will not break faith today.
I've been reborn in the light of the one true God, as have we all, as would any man who's seen the things we've seen.
I return to your service, my queen, if you'll have me.
I'll stay with him, with the Ironborn.
I took this castle from you. Let me defend you now.